I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. The sequester cuts are beginning to be felt at the Pentagon, which is scheduled to slash its budget by $500 billion over the next decade. So how is the Defense Department dealing with cutbacks after years of budget increases? Julian Barnes wrote about the development of the long-range strike bomber in the Wall Street Journal this week, called the Plane of the Future, as one example. He covers the Department of Defense and National Security for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau, joins us from the studios of the Wall Street Journal. And Julian Barnes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me here.
What's the significance, the importance of this particular plane, which is on the drawing board, called the long-range strike bomber?
This will be the replacement for the aging B-52s, which first went into service in the Eisenhower administration, and the B-1s. And it is a successor and will fly alongside the stealthy B-2. But this is going to be the first plane the Air Force has to design and build in this age of austerity that has come upon the military.
And it's interesting to look at how the Pentagon views austerity, because we are talking about a plane, as you describe, Julian, that if built would be about $500 million per bomber.
That's right. And it sounds like a lot to us.
It does.
But in Pentagon terms, that's inexpensive. The B-2 was something like $1.8 billion a copy, and that does not include the research and development costs that went into it. So if the Air Force can keep the cost to $500 million, it will be a victory for appetite suppressant, for holding off technologies that aren't ready, for building the plane they need, not more than the plane they need.
Your article begins with this description and discussion about whether this plane needs a kitchenette lounge.
That's right. Colonel Chad Stevenson, who is part of the team that's designing this airplane, and it's Colonel Stevenson's job to stop the plane from becoming gold-plated, to prevent requirements that aren't needed from being added. And he looked at this kitchenette, and he had a vision of some $300,000 crew rest area being added. You know, there was no formal cost estimate, but that's probably around the range of what the cost would be. In Pentagon terms, that's a drop in the bucket. But to Colonel Stevenson, this was not the way they were going about, this is not the way they wanted to go about this plane. They wanted to make sure that the plane is above reproach, that if a $10 cooler from Walmart and a lounge chair would do, let's spend $20 on that rather than $300,000. Save the money for what's important.
Fearing what, bad press? I mean, as we know, the Pentagon has a history of cost overruns, $500 hammers, things like that.
That's right. I mean, one can there certainly was that image in Colonel Stevenson's head as he looked at that. But what's different now than in the past is that the Air Force looked at this and said, look, if this cost rises, if we do not keep the costs under control, it's not that the taxpayers will pay more, we will not get this plane. With the enormous budget pressures on the Pentagon right now, all of the modernization programs are at risk, particularly something that's at the very beginning stages, like the bomber.
And looking even at the history of cost overruns and delays, I mean, was it because the Pentagon was so flush with money they could, in a sense, afford these overruns, and now we're in a new day?
There's something to that. I mean, there are many reasons that acquisition programs have gone off the rails over the last two or three decades at the Pentagon. There's been a decline in the number of professionals who work in this area. There's been a lot of turnover in the people who do that. There has been too much emphasis on untested technologies and developing the next new thing. But, you know, point of fact, the Air Force is trying to change its culture now. It was not part of the culture. Cost was a secondary requirement. The first requirements were, you know, range or payload or stealthiness. All of those things were the most important by far. And now cost is up there equal to the other parts of this plane.
It's really hard to change a culture, no matter if you're talking about the Air Force or any other institution.
Absolutely. And that is why the Air Force has, you know, imbued these colonel level people with some unusual power to say no. They have gone about this differently, trying to set the requirements for this plane early and get people to adhere to it. They look at planes like the F-22, which was a decade late and triple the price, and they ended up buying far fewer than that. And that's part of the worry here. The Air Force feels that small fleets are very difficult to manage, and they feel like they need 80 to 100 of these new bombers, and if the price goes up, they will be forced to buy a handful or none.
So where does the idea of a kitchenette lounge come from? I mean, is that someone just sort of free associating in front of a drawing board? Or are there efforts to try to add as much stuff to a plane like this by the builder themselves?
Well, you know, it's important to realize that all of these ideas that are presented for the new plane, it's not like they don't have merit. They do have merit. Adding a crew rest area will help pilots perhaps be better rested, make fewer mistakes. You know, there was the design contractor who was working on it, Lockheed Martin in this case, had good reasons for it. And some pilots wanted to see it. In fact, when my story came out, I heard from a bunch of former pilots who said, hey, that would be important. But for the Air Force, it's a balance act. And once they feel like once they start to say yes to these things, they'll keep piling up. There's another example of a sensor, a way to detect what's going on in the ground below the plane. The new bomber will have one sensor, but there was a proposal to add a second sensor, which would make it more like a spy plane. And there were a lot of people, including some people close to former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, who really liked that, who thought this would make the plane really better. But the Air Force said that's $25, $30 million added cost. We just can't add that right now.
I mean, these seem like little issues, kitchenette sensors, but are they?
Well, the kitchenette was a little issue, although it's easy to understand and it would be the kind of thing that the public could latch on. The sensor is a big deal. I mean, you know, at a $550 million plane, a $25 million cost is not insignificant. You know, so that is a more important example. But there were others. They've said no to new cyber defenses, deciding that existing cyber defenses are good enough. Other new technology. They want off-the-shelf stuff that's already proven to work.
And so this is something new for, and if we're talking about the Air Force, this is something new for them to live under this kind of austerity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had, you know, previous planes have been designed the B-52 was designed when Eisenhower was building up the nuclear forces. And not just Eisenhower, but Truman as well. The B-2 is a product of the Reagan buildup. And when that was first designed, you know, cost was just not an issue. F-22 was also began in the Cold War, even though it was not finished till well after. And we've had a whole decade where the Pentagon budget rose very quickly as a result of the war. Now, most of that spending was on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but there was just not a financial pressure. Yeah. Right now, because of the Budget Control Act, and then, as you mentioned, the sequester, the spending is coming down very quickly. And that means there are really hard choices in front of everyone right now.
But we do still have the largest Pentagon or defense budget in the world by far.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, people say, how can you not? It's a $500 billion budget every year, not including war spending. How can you not, over 10 years, cut a $500 billion or $1 trillion from that budget? And people say, yes, we could do that. The problem is the mechanism to do it, the sequester, which is cutting half of this $1 trillion the Pentagon's going to lose over the next decade, is a blunt instrument. And it requires things to be cut faster, and it doesn't address some of the cost drivers like compensation, health care, and the size of the military overall.
We did a show last week about the cuts in the food stamp program, $5 billion a cut from that program. And, you know, I realize you cover the Department of Defense, and that's it's a different world. But it's hard not to compare and contrast the kind of cuts and the kind of impact that those cuts have on individuals.
Absolutely. I mean, there, you know, one numbers at the Pentagon are very large. You know, small programs are millions and millions of dollars. You know, they don't even publish contracts that are below $6 million because too small. So when you compare that to other domestic programs, these numbers are very large. The problem is there are people involved here. The way the cuts are coming down, there are going to be tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of 100,000 people forced out of the military before they want to leave, who are essentially fired, who may have planned military careers, who won't be able to pursue them. So there is a human cost to these defense cuts. And what people at the Pentagon say is, listen, we can reduce this budget. It's just this is not the way to do it.
About a minute before our first break here, but you're talking about reducing the human force in the military, if people are going to be losing their jobs, or if there are cutbacks on things like bombers, that those people who make those bombers could lose their jobs?
Well, that's a good point. I was talking about people in the uniform military or civilian employees who are going to be downsized over the next years. But there's also a big fear in the industrial base, and there is members of Congress will tell you there is a way to manage programs so that we could make sure that those job losses are minimized. But the automatic across-the-board cuts will leave some people out of work at shipyards and at aircraft assembly plants.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Julian Barnes, our first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. He covers the Department of Defense and National Security for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. Wrote an interesting piece this week in the Wall Street Journal about the long-range strike bomber, a kind of plane of the future. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Friends Select, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Friends Select combines academics with real-world exploration in the classroom, in Philadelphia, and beyond. By asking questions and inviting students to make independent discoveries, Friends Select teachers do more than instruct. They strive to spark lasting fascination. An open house is Monday, November 11th. Full details at friends-select.org. Friends Select, fascination, forever bright.
This week in This American Life, their production of the play Peter Pan was not going well. The flying apparatus kept smacking characters into the furniture. Captain Hook appeared, gesturing grandly.
And then at a certain point, as he gestures, his hook flings off of his hand and flies into the audience and punches an old lady in the gut.
Fiascos this week on This American Life.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, have suburbs lost their cachet with millennials?
All evidence shows that they really want to be close to where the action is, and that can be in a kind of urban burb, but they want to be somewhere where they can walk to things, where they can be on their devices, and not being behind the wheel of a car for, you know, half hour, hours at a time.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Julian Barnes about the Pentagon, the Defense Department's budget, the fact that the DOD has to deal with some cutbacks. And again, Julian wrote about a plan for a long-range strike bomber in the Wall Street Journal this week, a jumping-off point for our discussion. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Julian, When a bomber like this is on the drawing board, are there discussions, talks about who is the enemy, what are we fighting, what is the nature of war? Does that come up in the kind of thinking for this kind of airplane?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that people look at the emerging kinds of things the U.S. will be asked to do in the decades to come when determining where they should put military spending. And the Air Force makes a pretty passionate case for the long-range strike bomber. They say if the United States sees more of a focus, security focus on Asia in the coming years, you need a bomber, something that has long range, something that can operate over long distances and project American power in a place that we have fewer bases than we do in the Middle East, in a place where new technology may be threatening the traditional aircraft carrier. You also look at what are the kinds of operations the U.S. has done around the world. You might point to Libya or the prospect of a strike in Syria. The Obama administration is hoping to avoid the kind of ground wars we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those are expensive. They have mixed results. The Obama administration's military strategy tries to steer clear of those. And so airstrikes, rapid reaction forces from the sky, are the kinds of things they put a priority on.
You have written about the competition between branches of the military, whether it's the Air Force or the Navy, the Marines or the Army, as these cutbacks begin to take to unfold or take place. There is some, sounds like, competition between these branches.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a top-line defense budget. It does not change. So a dollar that's taken, a dollar given from the Air Force is a dollar you cannot spend on the Army. And so there is a competition, sometimes stated, sometimes unstated. The Navy and the Air Force very much see this coming era as their era, where forces are needed rapidly. That's what the Air Force can provide. Where presence needs to be constant around the globe, that's what the Navy does. And the Army is trying to reshape itself into something that is relevant for the future.
And Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, has been, it seems, very much on the record about the reduction in forces and the reduction in spending.
Absolutely. If you listen to what Secretary Hagel says, is he very much assumes that the sequester is here to stay, that this additional $500 billion of dollars in cuts, atop $487 billion of cuts from a couple years ago, is going to remain law of the land. So he has started talking about what a smaller military would look like, and he talks about a dramatically smaller army.
And we're talking, when you add those two together, that's about $1 trillion.
That's right. Until 2023, we're looking at $1 trillion in cuts. And that does not, and people say, well, you know, that's just a small portion of the budget. But every year, healthcare costs go up for the military. Every year, retirement costs, benefit costs go up. If the size of the military is reduced, some of those costs will go down, but it takes a long time. So there's a lot of costs that go up every year that they can't control.
Let me get to, it looks like Alex from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, I know that some commentators have predicted that the military is going to become more of a almost like a social program or a social welfare program that occasionally attacks the enemies and kills bad guys, as opposed to being a strategic entity that is used to protect the United States' interests. I know that even Defense Secretary Hagel has mentioned the dangers of that. How close is that to becoming a reality with these cuts that are looking to go forward, especially where the cuts will be made?
Alex, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Julian, go ahead.
Well, you know, the way they're trying to make these cuts, and part of the reason why we see these competition is they want to preserve the parts of the military that are going to be used most often. We are going to see big cuts to armored divisions, to artillery, to the kinds of things that are only used in big ground campaigns, whereas special operations forces, Navy ships, Air Force planes are likely to be preserved because those are the kinds of things that are used. And they don't want to be a social welfare program. They don't want to just be employ people who sit around in a garrison.
And, Julian, final question to you. Assuming this long-range strike bomber is built, when do you think it'll be in the air?
Well, the goal is the mid part of the next decade, 2025. But, of course, it's been a long time since an Air Force Air Force plane came in on time. So it's anyone's guess. But the Air Force says if they stick to their plan, watch for it in 10 years.
So that's how long it takes, this silly question, that's how long it takes to build a bomber?
You know, it takes years to design it. Then they build prototypes, then they test them, and then, you know, every time they've tried to speed up the process by reducing the testing, it has led to huge problems. Now, in the World War II, you know, planes were designed and built and went into production in a year.
That's
but those
right.
are far, far simpler weapons that were designed to last a far shorter time. These are planes that will fly for 30, 40, 50 years.
Julian Barnes, thank you so much for getting our conversation started in this hour of Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He covers the Department of Defense and National Security for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. In fact, joined us from the studios of the Wall Street Journal. Well, with the end of one war, the winding down of another, and the changing nature of threats from countries to rogue or terrorist organizations, what's the role for the U.S. Army? Our guest Mark Thompson wrote about how the Army has been slow to adapt to a changing world for Time magazine, where he covers national security. And Mark Thompson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to chat with you, Marty.
Let me begin with a couple of things that you say in this article, and I'm curious about why, first of all, you wanted to focus on the Army and not other branches of the military.
Well, the Army, obviously, for the past decade has played the major role in the wars we have fought since 9/11. It has been essentially very well funded for that period of time, its budget doubling. For 4 years with war supplementals, the Army itself was collecting or spending $250 billion a year. Over 4 years, that's $1 trillion. With those wars having wound and now winding down in Afghanistan, there are going to be big changes coming for the Army, simply because that money is likely to be cut nearly in half. And yet, there really hasn't been a lot of sharp, smart thinking about how we want our Army to look in the 21st century. More importantly, none of the civilians seem interested in calling the Army into the dock and saying, hey, guys, how are we going to do this from here on out?
And
so that's why we wrote that article.
Well, and it was a very interesting article, but why do you think, for instance, resistance within the Army to deal with a changing world and obviously a changing role for the Army?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note the Army is the biggest service. It's the most hidebound service in both good and bad ways. It most clearly represents America that it defends with all of its good and its bad sides. The Army is the most traditional avocation going, except perhaps for the priesthood. And it embraces what it knows. It knows big tank battles on the plains of Germany, you know, the fruits of the Cold War with the Warsaw Pact. They continue to practice that kind of warfare out at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, and that has been neglected over the past decade. But the question is, what are the most likely things that are going to require a U.S. military response going forward, and it's not armored tank battles?
Well, it's interesting that you say that's really focused on fighting the Cold War, which has been over for some time now, and with all the threats of terrorism or cyber warfare, it's just so curious to me that they haven't been able to make that shift to deal more directly with those kinds of threats, as you write about it.
Well, I think it's important to point out that, number one, for the past decade, they were engaged largely in counterinsurgency warfare, something they had abandoned after Vietnam and swore never to do again. But they did it again. While they did it again, they neglected combined arms maneuver warfare, the real big armored tank battles. They're now getting back into that. They're not neglecting COIN, counterinsurgency, but they are saying that, you know, we need a toolkit filled with all sorts of tools for the future world. And the question, obviously, for taxpayers and soldiers and for their families is, well, what's the right balance there? And that's the issue now, because you can't do it all. The Army went from, you know, an armored force prior to 9/11 to a COIN force after 9/11, and now it's got to sort of, that speedometer needle has got to sort of come back somewhere into the middle, and that is the debate, frankly, that's going on both inside and outside the Army currently.
So there are about 500,000 active duty soldiers?
Yeah, that's right. There's a little more than 500,000. They're planning on coming down to about 490 by 2015, but very few people believe they will be able to hang on to that many personnel.
Why?
Well, because that supports 10 divisions. As Julian just said, you know, the Army is the service that is likely to take the biggest hits, and when you look at our pivot to the Pacific and the great expanses of ocean that is there, and the fact that the beaches are by and large owned or claimed anyway by the U.S. Marine Corps, you start going, well, what's really the Army's mission in the 21st century? And in our article, we spoke to a number of former and current serving Army officers, as well as Army outsiders, and if you're not in the Army today, you have serious questions about how the Army is calibrating itself, and the notion that the Army is going to stay at 490,000 from 2015 out is basically ridiculed by everybody except the top brass inside the Army.
Your article begins with special forces grabbing that al-Qaeda operative al-Libi off the streets of Tripoli, Libya. And is this, as we think about the future of the Army, is this what we should be thinking about?
Well, plainly, once again, the Army has to fulfill a variety of roles. But this is the future, or the foreseeable future, perhaps for the next generation. I mean, I talk to a lot of active duty Army officers who contend, you know, we really do need to be prepared to go to war in a major way with Iran or with North Korea. But most outsiders view that as highly unlikely, especially given the blood and treasure we have spent over the last 13 years in Afghanistan and Iraq, and consequently believe the focus can more smartly shift to these sort of light and agile missions. The key thing to understand, Marty, is the following. The budget cuts are going to make major changes in the Army inevitable. And the key thing is, should the Army acknowledge that and reorient itself in anticipation of that occurring, or, as they're currently doing, hug on to every red cent that they think they can get, and in that way, not have to make the tough changes that many people believe are necessary.
Well, you also write that members of Congress, most of whom have never served in the military, are loath to criticize the military, even to raise some of the questions we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important undergirding to this entire effort. Since 9/11, the military, for reasons good and ill, has been sacrosanct on Capitol Hill. Every time the Pentagon recommends a pay raise for the military, the Congress makes it more. Every time the Pentagon says, guys, you know, we need to trim these health care costs, Congress either refuses to do it or only does a little piece of what the Pentagon wants. I mean, the fact of the matter is, that a soldier now serving in the U.S. military makes more money in total compensation than 90% of his or her civilian cohort. That isn't to say that they're not worth it, but that's higher than it's ever been before. As Julian noted on health care costs, the fact is that those costs are now $50 billion a year. They were $19 billion a decade or so ago. And the paycheck slice of the Pentagon budget has gone from roughly 30% to 50% today. And eventually, as Arnold Panaro, the former Marine general, says, you know, we're going to become a benefits company that occasionally kills a terrorist.
You also say, and I keep quoting from your article, but it was an interesting one, which is that today the Army has one officer to five troops.
Yeah, I mean, we did trace that over time. Plainly, there are far fewer troops commanded by each individual officer. That is the nature of a bureaucracy. I don't care if it's U.S. military or public radio. It's funny how it ends up where you've got this carapace on top, and they all can't be doing stuff that is vital to the nation's security. We also note the military's current retirement system, which gives you nothing if you stay 19 years, but gives you 50% of your base pay if you stay 20, is an incentive for lots of, if not deadwood, at least not the best and brightest, to hang around, you know, after 12 or 13 or 14 years to be sure they make 20 and can get that pension. Well, maybe that fact requires a remaking of the military retirement system so that someone who stays for 10 years can feel free to leave without, you know, incurring a heavy penalty. But so long as the system is that way, you're going to be top heavy in the officer ranks.
Is this also sacrosanct, the idea of purging the generals or getting rid of some of these officers?
I don't think that is as sacrosanct as the basic pay paid to an enlisted soldier, but plainly, if you've been in the Army for a while, you know the ins and outs and how to get your way on Capitol Hill. And the fact is that both the president, who has never served in the military, Congress, which increasingly has not served in the military, there's almost a shadow of guilt on them, and especially in the wake of 9/11, the military was accorded proper respect. But in some ways, I think it has gone too far, and nobody is willing to call the troops to account, especially as the payroll eats up a bigger and bigger slice of the budget, and ultimately we shall end up with a military that's very well paid, but isn't able to do its mission very well because training and weapons and infrastructure have been short-sheeted.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Thompson, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. He's been covering national security in Washington for some time now, writes for Time Magazine. We're talking about an article he had in a recent edition of Time Magazine about the Army, the U.S. Army. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Bobby McFerrin Sunday, November 10th in Verizon Hall. Using music from his new album Spirit You All as a springboard, the polyphonic vocalist explores his everyday search for grace, wisdom, and freedom. McFerrin uncovers his roots in bluegrass, rock, funk, and Americana, staying true to his fearless improvisational approach and ceaseless exploration of the human voice. Bobby McFerrin, November 10th at the Kimmel Center. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
The HBO series Boardwalk Empire is introducing a lot of viewers to music of the 1920s. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with musician, arranger, and band leader Vince Giordano. He and his band, the Nighthawks, perform the music for the show. He's been obsessed with music of the 20s and 30s since he was a child. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
When bad memory makes good science.
She is very close to 100% incapable of forming new memories. She meets you one day and you come back the next day, she'll have no idea
who you are, she is living in a permanent present.
How an unusual brain injury has become a miracle for scientists trying to figure out how memory works. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. As two wars wind down, or one has been wound down, the other in the process of being wound down, and the nature of war changes and the defense budget being cut, our armed forces are going to have to alter their, quote, size, shape, and mission. And that's what our guest Mark Thompson writes about in Time magazine, about how the Army has been slow to adapt to all these changes. And he covers national security for Time. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Ed from Villanova joining us on Radio Times. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
If the Pentagon needs money, can't it dip into the black budget, which is supposedly the second biggest defense budget in the world?
Does it work that way, Mark?
Well, Ed, the black budget is fairly big, $50 billion a year, including intelligence, but that is money that is currently being spent. So if you want to suggest perhaps they should divert that to the more white side of the ledger, Sure, that's an option, but the military will tell you that many of the super secret programs contained in the black budget are vital to national security. And that, of course, is something that those of us on the outside have to sort of take at their word, because we don't know what they're doing. But it's fair, I think, as you suggest, to be skeptical.
Ed, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Mark, going back to you and something that you mentioned right before the break about training. I mean, if the Army is training soldiers for a Cold War, but obviously, you know, having dealt with Iraq and Afghanistan, it seems that on the ground, they're dealing with a very different kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to take a step back, Marty, and acknowledge that the Army's mission is to do what the president and, through the president, the people of the United States want it to do. You know, the Army is sort of our last ditch effort to prevail on the ground anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. That is its assignment. That is its mission. So even if there's only a very rare chance that it would have to go to war in Iran or have to go to war in North Korea, perhaps in 5, 10, 15, or 20 years, until the government tells the Army it does not have to do that, then it must be ready to do that. Let's face it, our Army is a Swiss Army knife of capabilities, you know, from nabbing terrorists with its Delta Force to prevailing in a massive tank battle. The question is, you can't do everything. Mm-hmm. You've got to train sort of to what is the most likely, but you must also keep sharp those tools that might rarely be used and not allow them to rust. And the fact of the matter is, for the past decade, the notion of combined arms maneuver has had a back seat. Now, if the United States wants to say, folks, we're not going to do that anymore, fine, then the Army can shed that mission. But until the nation says that, to some degree, the Army has to prepare for that type of conflict.
Either some kind of invasion on U.S. shores or being sent to another country to fight a battle there?
Well, that's part of the problem, obviously. As we talk in the article, the Army is trying to replace its Bradley fighting vehicle, a 35-ton vehicle that the Army is thinking of perhaps doubling in weight, 60 to 65 tons. The people I spoke to, including Dave Barno, a retired three-star officer who commanded all forces in Afghanistan from 03 to 05, you know, believe that's ludicrous, simply because as our garrison forces return from forward operating bases in Afghanistan and before that in Iraq, and as we continue to draw down slowly from Europe, more and more of our military might is going to be based here at home inside the United States. And that simply means that when the balloon goes up, or when a hot spot begins to boil over, we're going to have to send military might to those places. And in that case, plainly, a lighter is better, because you can ship more of them on a given ship, on a given airplane. And the notion that the Army is still embracing a nine-passenger ground combat vehicle strikes many military thinkers as somewhat backwards.
But as you write, this is a vehicle that would cost $30 billion. Do I have that right?
Yeah, if they buy as many as they want to buy. Sure, that too will come down. I mean, realize as the Army is shrinking, most likely well beyond the 490,000 that the Army itself wants to hang on to, they will be cheaper to outfit because they won't need as many weapons, and they won't need as many barracks, and they won't need as much health insurance. So there will be some bringing down in those numbers, but that is the current bogey on the screen for the Army.
But this is a vehicle, as you write, that would weigh 65 tons.
Yeah, I mean, once again, a vehicle that heavy couldn't go over many bridges around the world. It's very tough to transport. And as Barno told me, you know, one way the Army embraces heavily armored vehicles to defend itself, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, largely against roadside bombs or IEDs, as the military calls them. Well, Barno suggests that the way to avoid IEDs is not to invade and occupy a country for a decade. Now that is one way of moving to lighter armor, to decide that if we have a military mission, we're going to get in, we're going to get out, we aren't going to be sending our young men and women on tanks and armored personnel carriers for years on end on these hostile roads. And if you do that, well, maybe you don't need vehicles that are quite so heavy.
I think we all remember the press conference when some soldiers in Iraq were complaining to Donald Rumsfeld about the fact that they were so vulnerable in these vehicles as these IEDs were exploding around them.
Yes, the so-called hillbilly armor debate. And that was true because we sent to Iraq many Humvees. They were called soft-skinned Humvees because they had very little armor. They quickly began to up-armor them, but they weren't sufficient to do the job. When Iran began sending in EFPs, explosively formed penetrators, a super IED, MRAPs became inevitable. We spent $50 billion on MRAPs that nobody wants to use anymore. They've tested them in Korea. Korea has said thanks, but no thanks. The U.S. military in Korea does not think those weapons or those carriers will work well in the Korean terrain. So basically, there was a high price to be paid for that occupation in Iraq.
That's Mark Thompson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He has been covering national security for many years now. He writes for Time magazine, had an article in Time magazine that caught our attention about the U.S. Army and whether the U.S. Army is prepared to deal with the threats that face the world, this country, today. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Tim from Hillsboro. Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I would agree with what was just said about the Afghanistan situation as far as the MRAPs, but that was something that was pushed on to the military probably by big business and the government. But that's not my comment. My comment is you mentioned that 90% of the civilian force is not as well compensated as soldiers today. I would greatly disagree with that because we have soldiers today that are on food stamps. The numbers that you are quoting are inflated simply because you're using a healthcare system in the military that inflates that number. So please don't let these people think that soldiers are highly paid individuals. They're not. There are some soldiers today that are on food stamps. And I know about this because I served 8 years of active duty and 22 in the reserves. And I've been in Afghanistan twice and Iraq once. So I understand this whole concept. And I would agree to some of his points, but don't mislead this public by thinking that these soldiers are overpaid. They are certainly not. And as far as the pension system, you can't compare a pension system for working for some company at IBM because these young men and women can lay down their lives for this country where someone who's working at IBM works 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and goes home. These are young men and women work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They can be called out to work that kind of a schedule, and they do in some instances. So please don't compare that because you can't. It's not apples and apples. You're misleading this audience by giving that information out.
Well, Tim,
skewing the numbers.
Tim, hold on, because I want to give Mark Thompson a chance to respond. Mark, go ahead.
Well, Tim, thank you for your service. As I believe I said, I referred to total compensation, and it's true. you may not like that fact, and indeed cash is a relatively small slice of a military person's total compensation, but, you know, that health care and that retirement and those other bennies have to be paid somewhere, and the fact of the matter is that the Military Commission on Compensation, in their most recent report, said 90% soldiers do better in total compensation than 90% of their cohort. It's a fair point, what you suggest, that military service is different, much more dangerous, much more at the beck and call of commanders. But that doesn't change the numbers.
Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. But, Mark, are you saying it's – I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's not that these people aren't worth it. It's just that with so many people in the military, it's costing more and more.
Yeah, but I think the important thing is to note that that number, which is now at 90%, has gone up over the years, and we haven't really been paying attention. And what we need to do, and no one, at least not me, is suggesting that military pay or any other thing should be cut.
Right.
But I think we need to know, and Tim is right, you know, it's to make an apples-to-apples comparison is kind of tough. But, you know, when military retirees and other folks can get TRICARE at a bargain basement rate for the rest of their life, and the average person is now struggling to do that under so-called Obamacare, that's a benefit worth paying attention to.
Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. And, Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Rick. You're on the air. Yes, no, we don't seem to have Rick. Let me try Mac. And Mac looks like he's joining us from Downingtown. And Mac, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel of Marines. And I'd like to get back to, that's just not my comment, but when you talk about the cost and compensation, that's because they put a dollar amount, an artificial dollar amount on the value of healthcare that's provided to soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. It's not that they get it in their pockets. And I know when they used to do that to us, we all laughed that we were supposedly so highly paid. It was something that Congress did so that they could say that they're spending lots and lots of money on the armed forces. My real comment is when you talk about these things, it's all a result of getting to the all-volunteer force. The United States of America decided that it wanted to give a pass to most Americans so they wouldn't have to serve in the armed forces by canceling the draft. And when you go to an all-volunteer force, you're going to have to pay for it.
Hmm.
And when you ask people to make the sacrifices that they do, ask families to see their husbands go 3, 4, 5 times on 6 to 8 month deployments, and they're stuck at some base far from home, it's not unfair to the American people to give them health care that will let their husbands or their wives focus on the job that's at hand in a combat zone.
Yeah, and Mac, first of all, I'm sorry to jump in here. It sounds like we're losing you on your cell phone, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And again, I want to give Mark Thompson just a chance to respond to his comments, Mark.
Yeah, Mac is absolutely right, Marty. I mean, the nation has done a couple of sort of churlish things, I think. In 1973, it's now 40 years that we've had the all-volunteer force. It has become expensive on a per-soldier basis compared to a draft force. That has both pluses and minuses. On the plus side, the people who are there want to be there. The minus side is, because it's so expensive, you have to keep it relatively small. And that is why our soldiers, Marines, airmen, and sailors have had these repeated deployments in the war on terror since 9/11. And that, of course, has driven up all sorts of pathologies, ranging from PTSD to suicide and issues like that. But that's what happens when, as Mac points out, most of the nation can't be bothered fighting the nation's wars. And in the same way, that sort of culpability attaches to the Congress. The Congress has refused to declare war since World War II, and in that way, they get by with the so-called authorization for the use of military force, which is basically a fig leaf that sanctions presidential war making, but allows the Congress to wipe its hands of the conflict when things go south, and there isn't a declaration of war. And so long as we have basically a commander-in-chief commanding a small army pretty much at his will, we're going to face this conundrum.
But do you think, Mark, based on your years of reporting, that the Army, since we've been talking about the Army, can make the kinds of changes that we have been talking about?
Well, I think it's not a function of can they. They will have to make them. They will come because they are in a financial vise that is increasingly tightening. And the depressing thing is, with sequestration here, with nearly $1 trillion taken out of the Pentagon's budget for the coming decade, everyone is just sort of, you know, pulled their belt a little tighter, trying to keep the same belly, and that's just not going to work. And the fact of the matter is, you're going to cut off the blood flow if you keep tightening that belt. And a smarter way might be to start with a fresh sheet of paper and say, this is our budget going forward, this is what we're going to have to live with. What's the best way to accommodate those cuts?
Well, on that note, and as always, Mark Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome, Marty.
And he covers national security for Time. In fact, won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. And we began our conversation talking with Julian Barnes, who covers the Department of Defense and national security for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. Wanted to get us all up to speed on some issues and debates taking place within the Pentagon about budget cuts. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.